they granted me permission on basis of compelling and compassionate reasons.
U.S. diplomacy on tour in Asia. It's Wednesday, March 17th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us online. We're at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, scars of war remain. Joe Biden tries to stimulate interest. Virtual growth for higher ed. Medical heroes. Fortified masks. It's all on today's VOA Asia. We begin today with the latest on Myanmar, where the United Nations is warning that food and fuel prices in Myanmar are steadily rising due to the current political unrest triggered by last month's military coup. The World Body's Food Assistance Branch, World Food Program, issued a statement that rice prices have risen across the country by an average of 3% from mid-January to mid-February. But the WFP says prices have ballooned anywhere between 20 and 35% in a few townships in the northernmost state of Myanmar. The agency also says the retail price of palm oil has spiked up to 20% since the beginning of February. Meanwhile, the top U.S. diplomatic and defense officials have arrived in Northeast Asia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin are holding talks in Japan and South Korea. China and North Korea expected to be high on the agenda. Jason Strother reports from Seoul.
The trips to Seoul and Tokyo are the secretary's first overseas travel as envoys of the Biden administration. The officials are in the region to shore up support among America's closest allies as a counterweight to an increasingly assertive China. A White House strategy paper released last week says that Beijing poses the greatest threat to the current international system. But Secretary Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan are expected to hold talks with China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi and Chief Diplomat Yang Jiechi in Anchorage, Alaska later in the week. The officials are also expected to look for common ground with allies on how to persuade North Korea to return to the negotiating table. The Biden administration has tried reaching out to Pyongyang, but has received no response, according to multiple media reports. A review of U.S. strategy toward the North is currently underway. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
Down under, fugitive lawmaker Ted Hui has become the first Hong Kong politician allowed into Australia during the COVID-19 pandemic. China has accused Canberra of interfering in its domestic affairs. From Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us more.
Pro-democracy former Hong Kong lawmaker Ted Hui has been at the center of some unruly scenes in Hong Kong's parliament. He once threw a bag of rotten plants into the Legislative Council chamber to disrupt a debate. He fled Hong Kong while on bail in 2019 in a case related to anti-government protests, but still faces national security charges. He went to Europe, but has been granted a visitor's visa by Australia. Australia closed its borders to foreign travellers a year ago because of the pandemic, but Hui has been given special permission to fly to the northern city of Darwin. He arrived this week with his family, and all are in mandatory COVID-19 quarantine. Hui told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that he was grateful for Canberra's support.
I did explain to the Australian government about my situations and what my family is experiencing as an exile. They granted me permission on basis of compelling and compassionate reasons. I could actually get on a repatriation flight with other Australians going home. It was very kind of the Australian government, and I'm grateful for everything it's given for me.
Hui believes he's better placed to fight for democracy in Hong Kong in exile in Australia with other like-minded activists. He's called for a stronger international response to national security laws imposed by China in Hong Kong. However, China's Foreign Affairs Ministry has accused Australia of meddling in its domestic politics and harbouring a fugitive. Relations between Australia and its biggest trading partner are at their lowest in decades. The list of disagreements is long. There has been friction over Canberra's call last year for a global inquiry into the origins of the new coronavirus and allegations of Chinese interference in Australian politics. In a sign of escalating tensions, Beijing has imposed restrictions on several Australian farm exports, including barley and wine, and on coal. China is Australia's biggest trading partner. Analysts say Hoi's arrival in Darwin will add more friction to an increasingly tense relationship. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You'll find more on these and all the stories you hear on VOA Asia on our Facebook page at VOA Asia, also on Twitter and our website, voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Food and fuel prices rising in Myanmar in aftermath of coup, according to the United Nations. Top U.S. officials in Asia on first overseas visit. Critics raise alarm over EU-China deal. Afghan minister warns U.S. against hasty retreat. Facebook signs deal to pay Australia's News Corp for content. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are found online at Facebook at VOA Asia and our website, voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We continue with VOA Asia. The war in Nagorno-Karabakh between Armenia and Azerbaijan in 2020 is still very present in the daily lives of its people as they work to rebuild and heal amid a peace that many see as fragile. Jonathan Speer narrates this report by Pablo Gonzalez.
This video, obtained from villagers, shows how last November, before the advance of the Azeri troops, the residents of this small Armenian village in Nagorno-Karabakh set fire to their own houses and fled to Armenia's capital, Yerevan. After the Russian-brokered peace accords, the village found itself on the Armenian side of the conflict. Now residents and volunteers have returned to rebuild.
I have come from Armenia to reconstruct this house, and not only me, every day more people arrive to help rebuild this village quickly so that people can return and live in peace.
This village bears just some of the many scars that the war has left in these mountains, a war that left the hills riddled with bombs that bomb squads are now working to clear. The new borders created by the conflict are now controlled by Russian peacekeepers, in charge of enforcing agreements between the two sides.
This is the shortest distance to the Azeri troops, 40 meters. Only Russian soldiers pass this road. This is their work area. They are there to help in case of conflict, but everything has been quiet after the signing of the ceasefire.
Peace came after a savage war that ruined the area's economy, left thousands dead and tens of thousands of people homeless. Authorities say rehousing these people is now the priority.
To solve the housing problem, we are building emergency houses, and in turn, Russia is building 1,200 homes.
The agreements signed by Armenia and Azerbaijan are in force, but the issues remain unsettled. The deals have Azerbaijan retaining control of areas that it took in the war, and Armenia has had to withdraw from some areas. For people here, there is peace, and at the same time, no surrender. The tension and fear of the bombs has disappeared, but few think the calm is guaranteed.
But
the people of Karabakh are peace-loving, but at any moment we can change the shovel for the rifle and the tractor for the tank.
Peace has arrived, but the dangers of war are still present for these children, who are now learning to identify and avoid grenades and landmines, and who will carry the experience of war for life. For Pablo Gonzalez in Stepanakert, I'm John Speer, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, Myanmar security forces shot dead two people overnight in Yangon, according to independent broadcaster, the Democratic Voice of Burma. The United Nations said at least 138 protesters have been killed since the coup on February 1st. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Tell a friend to join you as we continue. This week, President Joe Biden is traveling the nation after signing a $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package and as Americans begin to receive stimulus checks. Meanwhile, Washington is again looking at immigration as it debates as to how to handle a surge of migrants arriving at the U.S. southern border. Michelle Quinn reports.
President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are traveling as part of a so-called Help Is Here tour to promote the $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package he signed into law last week. Touted as one of the most sweeping anti-poverty measures in decades, the package includes $1,400 stimulus checks for many Americans and a new $3,600 per child tax rebate for parents. No Republicans voted for the measure, arguing it was too big and unfocused.
Republicans want to make sure people get shots in the arms, kids get back to school, people get back to work. But we are not going to stand with the Democrats as they try to exploit a crisis.
Democrats point to recent polling that shows a majority of Americans supports the package. A poll by CNN, for example, found that 61% of respondents support the relief measure.
You can be sure that all of their states and communities will be benefiting from this, and they won't be complaining about it back home.
Meanwhile, Washington is at odds over how to handle a surge of migrants at the U.S. southern border. The situation has led to finger-pointing, with some Republicans saying that Biden's rollback of immigration measures implemented by former President Donald Trump are to blame for the surge. Democrats argue that it was Trump's policies that set up the situation today. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Officials from the United States and Japan met to discuss their shared worry over China's growing territorial ambitions in the East and South China Seas as the Biden administration tries to reassure key regional allies. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, 1 year after many universities and colleges in the United States shut their doors and transitioned to virtual learning in response to COVID-19, the ripple effect continues to impact higher education. VOA's Giuseppe Minoni has more.
As communities across the United States wrestled with staggering numbers of coronavirus cases last March, hundreds of universities and colleges closed their campuses, disrupting the lives of their faculty and students.
I had to keep thinking, like, I don't know where I'm going to go. It was, like, really stressful.
Higher education students, most younger than 29, are among the least vulnerable to severe illness from the virus, according to the CDC. However, researchers at Imperial College in London found that young adults are also among the biggest spreaders in communities and pose a threat to those with weakened immune systems. Without a national strategy for how schools should respond, educational institutions took different approaches, with some changing their approach on the fly. First, they sent students home, then they brought them back, only to send them home again.
Frankly, it was kind of hit and miss because schools were changing quickly.
By the end of spring semester, most schools had adopted online or hybrid learning models.
Schools that had very limited online presence were transforming themselves into online education institutions. We're transferring hundreds, sometimes thousands of courses into online delivery.
But students complained virtual learning offered a second-rate educational experience, riddled with technological issues and a lack of support and resources.
It's frustrating because I feel like I'm paying this much to teach myself on YouTube.
Enrollment for the fall semester dropped. Schools lost money.
On a number of levels, it's a lack of the capacity to do fundraising, to hold big events, to hold football games and fundraisers, booster events that go along with that.
In the fall, many schools reopened dorms and partially resumed online operations, but some were quickly forced to close for a second time because of coronavirus outbreaks. Still, some students who returned said campus life was worth the risk. For international student Tay Ayodeji, 10 months of remote learning from Nigeria had taken a toll.
It was really hard with the time difference. Also, like, in Nigeria, the Wi-Fi isn't really great, so there was technological issues all the time.
In schools that have succeeded in staying open, COVID precautions have become a way of life.
Now it's March. I literally have a bucket of masks in my dorm, hand sanitizer. At school, we have to get tested twice a week, and we have to fill out a COVID monitoring form. So it's like, I'm just gotten used to it.
With available vaccines and fewer new cases of COVID-19 in the U.S., experts predict a return to a somewhat normal schedule for the fall classes. This is welcome news for students who say the virus has cheated them out of their college experience.
The idea of being able to live on campus, have very good, like, connections with professors, you know, like that kind of, like, sense of community, which is very different from, like, what schools in Colombia offer. Now it feels like there's no real difference.
There is one piece of good news for incoming students. A number of colleges and universities have waived standardized test requirements, removing an enrollment hurdle for the upcoming year. Jesus Semeoni, VOA News, Washington.
Making headlines in Asia, Kim Yo-jong, the sister of North Korea's leader, criticized ongoing military drills in South Korea and warned the new U.S. administration against causing a stink if it wants peace, according to state media. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, after the pandemic began, COVID medical workers became modern-day heroes. Vladimir Lensky has the story of a New York City artist who created a portrait series to honor them. Anna Rice narrates.
Dr. Anthony Fauci didn't make Time Magazine's Person of the Year in 2020. But this is how New York City artist Tim Okamura has portrayed Fauci the year the coronavirus pandemic hit.
And some of them, you could see him looking kind of dejected. You could see him, like, you could see Trump sort of in the background talking. And, you know, it was funny to see, like, Fauci's expression. And just trying to capture a sense of, a sense of stoicism and intellect and thought and sort of his presence in the, you know, the pantheon of American sort of, you know, personalities that have been at the forefront during this pandemic.
Okamura has also focused on nurses.
I'm living across the street from Wyckoff Heights Medical Center, which is absolutely full of COVID patients. And in fact, where one of the first COVID patients in New York was treated.
Yeah.
And also unfortunately passed away.
Yeah.
So I was seeing, you know, medical workers going in and out of the hospital daily. I was seeing, you know, their stress and the strain that they were going through.
Okamura adjusted his art to the new reality and learned to paint face masks and gloves. He dedicated special attention to the doctors and nurses' name tags because most of their faces were covered with protective equipment.
As people, when you're trying to connect with somebody, you feel that there's kind of a barrier between you and that person, but the eyes are where you're going to find you know, that interaction.
Jenny V can only be recognized when you look into her eyes. When she's at work, she always wears a mask. After working a 12-hour shift at a vaccination site, she says the vaccines offer hope.
It feels great because, you know, it's signaling an end to a pandemic, hopefully, sooner rather than later. And it's nice to see that, you know, people are coming in for it and, you know, just excited to get it, just as excited as we are to give it.
NYU Langone Health lowered its flags to honor the COVID victims. Back in May, after V worked long hours fighting COVID, she found it hard to come down during her two-hour drive home. That's when Okamura met her.
We were never taught in nursing school on how to handle a pandemic. When it hit, we were all, you know, we were scared ourselves. You know, we all have families, young children, elderly parents. And when the pandemic hit, we were just pretty much trying to figure out how to get by day to day.
V says while COVID vaccines are a light at the end of the tunnel is very long. She hasn't seen Okamura's portrait of her yet, just a picture on Instagram. When it's safe to do so, Okamura will give it to her as a gift, like he will gift the other portraits of medical workers as a way to give thanks and remember the pandemic's toll on human lives. For Vladimir Lensky in New York, NRI's VOA News.
At the beginning of 2020, a swimwear factory in the United States making designer bathing suits was producing hundreds of them a day. But COVID changed everything, and so this company belonging to designer Carla Coletto had to adapt to survive like so many others. Maxim Moskalkov dives into the story.
Since April 2020, this factory in Vienna, Virginia has been producing face masks and medical attire instead of designer swimwear. That's because it had to. Sales of Carla Coletto designer swimwear fell by 75% when COVID hit.
We knew we needed to start to do something different to keep ourselves in business. We were forced to halt our swimwear production. And at the time, we also noticed that the hospitals and the doctors and nurses were in dire need of PPE.
The company started producing reusable face masks. Some are infused with nanoparticles of copper, which has antibacterial properties. And what's also special, this mask can survive up to 30 washes.
We realized that, you know, the processes of making a mask were very similar to making a swimsuit. A lot of the techniques and the components were complementary.
So far, the Carla Coletto brand has produced over 22,000 reusable masks and over 15,000 medical gowns. A special water-resistant coating allows them to keep their antibacterial properties through 30 washes.
You know, there were so many things to take into consideration with the pandemic. I mean, we had to rearrange machinery for social distancing. There were, all the CDC guidelines that we needed to follow.
As a result, Carla Coletto managed to both keep her business afloat and help others. Today, her company works together with a number of charity organizations and initiatives.
A portion of our mask sales are donated to Fashion Girls for Humanity. And then, of course, we have the gown initiative that we continue to work on.
The nonprofit Fashion Girls for Humanity was founded in 2011 after a devastating earthquake in Fukushima, Japan. In 10 years since its creation, its mission has been to raise money for humanitarian initiatives and emergency services. After COVID, however, the efforts were aimed at helping medical workers.
We decided to raise money so that we could pay the factory workers and then donate the gowns to the most needed hospitals and medical institutions. This is how we came to, working with Carla Coletto.
Carla Coletto herself says her factory will keep working on its humanitarian mission and will keep producing PPE for as long as it is needed. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Vienna, Virginia.
We're glad you could join us today for VOA Asia. Come back again tomorrow at the same time. And in between, you'll find us online. VOA Asia Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Don't forget YouTube. We also like to thank those who help bring this program to you. Our managing editor, Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.